Hello and welcome to another installment of History Hack. We have with us today, we're thrilled, we've got Simon Verdigan with us, who is basically the Indiana Jones of Belgium. Not to bill him too highly. Beth, why is he the Indiana Jones of Belgium?
He just is, isn't he? That's just his title, Chief Archaeologist of all of Belgium. So Simon is a archaeologist, conflict archaeologist. His most current project, Skylarks, that he set up recently, is a process that he's hoping will help to identify those who have been recovered in Belgium over the last 30 years from the First World War. And he's obviously well known doing his archaeology across the Ypres Salient and finding all of the really, really good stuff. Hi, Simon.
Hi, y'all. Thank you for having me.
How are you basking in your new celebrity status after giving that talk at the beginning of the week?
Uncomfortable.
Yeah. Was a little bit creepy in some places, wasn't it?
Oh, just a little.
Yeah. And Lockie's here as well. You're all right, Lockie.
Yeah, I'm here. I'm just going to grill Simon further about the discovery of one of my rugby club players. That's what mainly what I'm here for.
Excellent. Because we are here, we are going to talk about Simon's work looking at the missing. Basically, when someone finds someone on the Western Front, remains of a soldier, Simon gets a phone call. And then he puts on his superhero outfit and he goes out and he exhumes them. And it's his job to try and give back these remains, give them back their identity. Simon, how long have you been doing this?
Almost 10 years now. My first major archaeological dig on the Western Front was in 2012 in Messines. And ever since, I've done almost nothing else but First World War excavations.
It's what you wanted to get into, isn't it?
I always wanted to do something with the First World War. I studied history first. I couldn't really find my way in there. So I decided to do archaeology with just one purpose, and that was to get into First World War archaeology.
So, Simon, obviously you've just briefly touched on there your background and how you got into archaeology and the fact that you do recover remains and you're part of the exhumation process. How is that work actually done? Can you just take us through the process of how that happens?
There are two kinds of excavations, two types. So there are the regular excavations. So that's when building or construction works are planned, and then archaeological teams have to come in. And when that's on the First World War battlefield, there's always a chance of finding human remains. And then the recovery will be part of the bigger excavation going on that area and or that field or that site. So in that case, the team is already present, and they do the steps that I will explain a bit later. The other case is when it's a chance find. So that can be a farmer that's plowing, metal detectorist that's going over a field. If there's construction or work going on in a garden or in a smaller area that is not where archaeology was not necessary, or because the area was too small, or whatever reason it was. And then there's everybody is obligated to call the police that they found the human remains. And then the police contacts the local archaeologists, and then our team is called in to do the actual recovery. So when we are going out, or when we are doing a recovery, if it is in a chance find or on an archaeological excavation, it usually takes us 1 to 2 days per body, with a team of two archaeologists and a physical anthropologist. So we open up the area so that we know in what kind of context he's situated, if it is in a bomb crater, a trench, a field grave, whatever possible. Sometimes he's just scattered remains on the surface or just below the surface. Then we clean the remains in situ, so that we have an idea of if it's one individual or multiple individuals, and how he's positioned, if he's buried properly or if he just dropped where he was killed and he's still in that same position. And then we do our recording. So that means we do a lot of photography, regular photography, archaeological photography with scale bars and north arrows, but also photography for 3D models, so that we can make a 3D model out of it, and also an orthophoto, so that's a photo that you can see straight down, which fits in our GIS program, so that we know the exact location of the individual and the find location. And then when all that is done, the physical anthropologist makes his or her notes. She looks at the stuff she needs to know. And then we start the actual recovery. So that means that we lift piece by piece, artifacts, but also the remains. And each item is recorded with a GPS, so we always know where what was found. Even the smallest button, an example, stripes on the shoulder or on the bottom of a sleeve can mean something completely different. So you have to know where it's found to, in the later process of identification, that can make a difference in narrowing down the list of the person in situ. So when that is done, everything is taken to our depot, and there everything is cleaned. So the human remains are washed and dried so that they can be studied by the physical anthropologist in greater detail. So they look at stature, age, sex, but most cases that's clear, of course, in our First World War recoveries, but also cause of death, if that's possible, maybe some trauma that happened before or diseases that he might have had during his life. So that's all kind of data that they assemble based on just the skeletal remains. And we look at the artifacts themselves. So the artifacts get also cleaned, and we make an inventory of each piece. We make photographs of it, and then that will all be get together in a first report that we, together with the remains and the artifacts, give back to the police. And then it's the police that gives it to the Belgian War Grave Commission, and they then hand it over to the relevant authorities of the nation where the soldier is origin from.
You've been doing this a while. I mean, do you remember the first body you found?
That was the first excavation in 2012 in Messines.
Has the process changed much in that time?
Quite a bit, yeah. Back then, we didn't have the time to take the remains and the artifacts back to the office. So we just had the time to open up the area and clean the remains in situ and have an idea of the context and do our photographs there. But then the police came in and they took everything with them, remains and artifacts. So the only data that we were able to gather was what we had at that moment. Of course, all the study of those items and the remains in that time were done afterwards by the Commonwealth War Grave Commission or other authorities. But we, from an archaeological perspective, always lacked some kind of information that we now have the opportunity to gather when we are back at the offices.
How did it feel? I mean, if it's your first time, I guess, speaking from a battlefield guide perspective, I walk around places like Tyne Cot, and I'd sometimes need to check myself because I feel so comfortable at places like that, I almost sort of forget where I am from time to time, and maybe that comes with time. But the first time you go there, surely you're here, and I feel like maybe it's like that uncovering your first set of human remains. But how is it?
It was the very first that I saw was during an internship, but that was just like from a distance because we were not, as students, were not allowed to be part of that process. So we could have a look and watched it. So in my opinion, that wasn't the first bodies that I recovered, but the one I did as an archaeologist, as a responsible like field archaeologist, was my excavation, and that's something I will always remember. I remember because it was Paul Reed and Peter Doyle were there, because they were following us for the TV program on Channel 4. I remember that the moment I noticed that we had human remains, I ran off to them to say that we actually found it. And the whole process from that point on, the discovery and the opening up of that context and cleaning the remains, it's like yesterday.
Did you find any identifying features on him?
He was from the New Zealand Rifle Brigade, so okay. He had his shoulder titles. He did have like a mouthpiece for like some extra teeth that he lost, and there was one gold teeth within that piece. So we hoped that would be something lead to his identification, but unfortunately they got stuck somewhere in a list that was still too long, so we never knew. So he's buried there at the Messina Ridge Commonwealth Cemetery as an unknown New Zealand soldier from the Rifle Brigade. So there was his story's end. But it's unfortunately that's one of many cases because identification is very hard. But at least he's with his mates in the cemetery and no longer somewhere out there. So that's already a satisfactory end of the story.
How many soldiers have you found now?
About 200 at the moment. I think most of them I still remember as good as the first one, because it's something that you take home every time.
And how many have you been able to identify?
Only four, I'm afraid.
Four. Okay, and one of them is my guy from the rugby club.
He was the first, so I'll definitely never forget him.
Yeah, I mean, for those who haven't heard me boring on about the story, never mind Simon being interesting about it. This was a player who came from New Zealand, came up to England on an army scholarship, really talented athlete, great sportsman, and came to the best rugby club in the world, which is Blackheath Rugby Club in South East London, where he played for a short time before joining his regiment, which was the Warwickshire regiment, and he was killed at Second Ypres in May 1915. It was quite exciting for me as a kind of military historian attached to Blackheath Rugby Club when news of Simon's discovery became apparent anyway. So what was that process like?
He was found during a large-scale excavation in 2016. We were advancing on a big gas pipeline that had to be put in place near Langemark. So we did a first, I think, 16 kilometers in 2014-2015, and then that was a second, like a side branch that ran from Langemark all the way down to Mousetrap Farm. So it was actually there that we started, and going all the way up north, which was about 8 kilometers. And we knew we had to go to the field that was from Oblong Farm and the road from Saint-Jean to Saint-Julien. So where all the counterattacks in April 1915 took place. So first the Canadians and then later the 10th Brigade. So we knew there was quite a large or big chance that we would find human remains on that field. But Kitchener's Wood is mainly linked to the Canadians and their heavy losses. And the 10th Brigade is kind of a more or less, if I can say, forgotten counterattack, or less well known as the Canadians. So everybody was warning us, watch out for bodies, and very likely they'll be Canadians. I think in the first stretch was about 300 meters, 13 meters, 15 meters wide. We discovered 15 bodies, of whom one German and all the others, I think two were just scattered remains that we couldn't link to a nationality, and all the others were Commonwealth troops. So we had some, you know, like GS buttons and typical Commonwealth equipment, webbing stuff and that. But no signs of Canadian troops. So we were kind of in doubt, what period are we looking at? That was a doubt until we found that one bomb crater where Captain Walker was in. Of course, at that moment, we didn't know who we were looking at. But the first thing that we discovered, because he was kind of still sitting on the edge of the bomb crater, was his skull, and he still had his cap on with a Warwickshire badge. So that was the first thing that we discovered. So that immediately took us that to that 25th of April, 1915. And when we opened up the entire bomb crater, there was another guy, also Warwickshire, but a regular soldier, lying on top of him. And Captain Walker, of course, was quite early in the process. We found out that he was an officer based on his buttons and his collar insignia and some of the other equipment that he had with him. So that narrowed down the list immediately from, I think, because at the beginning, they had 190 or something missing for just that one day. So in the beginning, we thought that it was going to be nothing again until it was an officer. Then the list narrowed down to, I think, 11. And then at some point when we were lifting all the artifacts, we found a medallion with some initials engraved in it, but it was in some kind of a handwriting that we couldn't make out what it was at that moment. And I still remember I was one of those evenings at home looking through files with that I could find online on officers from the Warwickshires. I think it was, I don't recall which file it was exactly, what source, but it was signed on the bottom with Henry John Innes Walker, and the capitals were exactly the same as on the medallion. So next morning I went to the find box and I had another look, and then I decipher that it was exactly those initials. Oh, so that at that moment we knew.
Lockie, did you know that about him sitting there with his hat on still?
No, I didn't. I mean, from the accounts that I'd read, he had a nasty abdominal wound. I think he was last seen kind of in a shell crater, mm-hmm. kind of, you know, trying to look after this horrible wound that he'd got. So it sounded awful. Like, it sounded more like one of the really nasty deaths. But then not seen again. Posted missing, presumed killed after the war. Recorded on the Menin Gate, and so that was the spot to visit him. Yeah. But now he has his grave at New Irish Farm Cemetery, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There were actually quite, I think, 10 or 15 accounts that we found. I think it was Alex that found them for us. That from soldiers that were in the area and that witnessed what happened with him. Some said he was shot through the head. Others said he was riddled by machine gun fire. But he jumped out of a Jack Johnson hole and was immediately hit and fell back into it. And that's where we found him, still sitting on that edge. And apparently, I think two or three accounts mentioned that he jumped up with his revolver in his hand and said, like, come on, lads, or something like that. And then he was hit.
Lockie, are you guys in touch with his family?
We're actually not. I've kind of... It's on my to-do list.
Unfortunately, the Great War Group.
On mine too.
Yeah, the Great War Group weighed in and destroyed your to-do list, didn't they?
A little bit. I mean, I know they've been quite busy because The Imperial War Museum's project running through the centenary had quite a lot of information on him. So there's been quite a bit of, sort of contribution about him, besides, you know, Simon's work as well. So, you know, there is some interest, and, you know, quietly between all of Blackheath's, you know, casualties and losses through the war, there's quite a lot of the war covered.
There were also quite some of his letters home that were published on a local newspaper in New Zealand. So we have them. So those letters probably are still with the family, and maybe a lot more. We Skyped with his the son of his father. The son of his father's brother. So he was still alive, or is still alive. So his father was a way younger than Captain Walker, but he recalled his father talking about his lost brother, and he showed a few items. So they must have, he had like an entire album, I suppose, with photographs, and he had another case with initials, the same initials as we found on his binocular case. So I also would like to get in touch and see if, because it's an amazing story. There's a lot about him, like sports wise, but also in the army. According to his family, he was a good friend of Montgomery at the time as well, one of his closest friends.
Oh, really?
But he was wounded during that attack, so he didn't participate on that fatal day. He also wrote home about Christmas truths and stuff like that. He actually mentions a football game with a cap. I know it's a risky subject to touch, but
it's not Christmas yet. It's okay.
No, it's a published letter, so I would love to see the original, just as like some kind of.
I still think the Great War Group needs to make a documentary about you finding him and Lockie following his past, and definitely. As soon as we can travel again, we'll talk.
Definitely. So, Simon, obviously that's a really iconic story. We all know, those of us who know you know about that dig and what you did as part of it. But are there any others that have really stood out for you as maybe a bit unusual, something a bit out of the ordinary, something that you maybe came across that you didn't expect to find?
I think the mass graves that we found at Dig Hilleti, the German soldiers, that was something extraordinary as well, because the total site on itself also, because we found 110 bodies on.
What's it like though? What's the difference? Like finding one guy, but what's it like when you just keep, you dig and you dig and you keep finding more and more? That must be quite emotional.
It is, and it makes you realize the enormity and the scale of losses that happens on just small areas and just in, sometimes just a few moments. All those guys were probably killed in just a few days in November 1914, when Bavarian troops took the village, and they were pushing the French at that time out of the village, and then a few counterattacks, and they probably lied around there for a few days, and they were, as far as we assumed based on archaeological evidence and the historical evidence that we have, they were all buried by other units and not by their own, because the chaos and the enormity of the losses, because I think they had 6,000 missing still for those few days, all the Bavarian division that took part of that battle.
Gosh. And do you find when you are uncovering these mass graves, I don't know, I've not been involved in anything like this, so I wouldn't say, but I almost imagine, do you try and picture with any exhumation, I suppose, do you try and imagine for the ones you can't identify who they might have been, what they might have lived through? Do you try and piece together some sort of little identity for them?
Each one, yeah. Of course, in a small percentage, it's just a few pieces, and then that's almost impossible. it's scattered remains or just like some, yeah, that you know that was one at one point an entire body, but it's partially or almost entirely lost. That's difficult to imagine that it has been a person, although you know it was, but it's, yeah, it's too far too far out to have a picture. But in all the other cases, yeah, I always say it's like when you're there, it's like you're in a kind of a work mode. You have that focus on all the details that you need to take into account and that you need to record and that are important. But once you start driving home, you start to think about that emotional part that you are actually, yeah, recovering a person that's been missing for at least 100 years. And then I, yeah, sometimes there's no clue, but if there is a clue or just a small piece that you can start looking into, then yeah, the following days, each night I will always be, yeah, trying to find as much as possible with, yeah, the possibilities I have from here, of course, you know, online sources. And
I know we're going to talk to you about the emotional side of this, but I want, so when I went to Auschwitz, right, the one thing that, there was one object that really stung me, and I wonder if Lockie and Beth have had this as well, and it was, you know, when you're walking around the museum, randomly it was a cheese grater, and it's just in a glass case on its own, but for me, the fact that a woman somewhere, I presume it was a woman, decided that she needed to throw her life into a suitcase because she was being herded onto a train, and she put that cheese grater in there, and the tragedy is she thought she might have a use for it at some point when we know what was planned for her. That really broke me. Is there anything you found that you've just really found hard to deal with?
It's, if you find those personal stuff, that's indeed always much more emotional than just the military equipment. Of course, it's very uncommon to find them, because if they are buried by their comrades, then most of that stuff is taken away to be sent back. So it doesn't always happen. And there's not an example coming to me right now, but... Sorry.
I suppose one of the things that kind of struck me, kind of some of the things that I've heard about kind of being in the minds of Great War soldiers, is the idea that they wouldn't ever want to be lost. So, you know, take a British soldier, for example, you know, they'd wear a kind of identity disc, which turned into discs, a couple of things, but you know, these could easily get lost. And so I've heard of, you know, Great War soldiers actually making their own to kind of attach to various parts of them, you know, a little kind of tin thing that they've you know, scraped their name or number onto, that they then wear around their wrist or ankle or something like that. So I mean, I guess that's kind of one of the things that makes me kind of just click a little different way, the fact that, you know, okay, could be killed, but absolutely the last thing they want is to be lost. Do you ever find anything along those lines at all? I suppose you'd be able to identify more if you did find those things.
Yeah, well, that's the problem with those things, with identity discs, is that especially in the beginning, they didn't realize that they just had a single one and they had to take them off. So the body was left behind without the disc. So, and then fortunately they realized they had to do the double disc, but then the material is not good enough to last until now, 100 years later. But we do find their need to, and I don't know if that's their need to be recovered later and to be identified, but luckily some had like the need to own their objects and write their initials on it. And that's the kind of stuff that we do find. And we always hope and look for when we find personal stuff, is we turn them around 100 times and look at it in different lights and underwater and clean it again. And we even sometimes use baby powder, because that, if you rub it in, you can sometimes see the initials come out. You try everything because you know most of them mark their own stuff. But only if they realized that it would be useful to us 100 years later, they might have done it a bit more. Because when you look at witness accounts and personal accounts, it's indeed one of their biggest fears. It's to go missing and not to be found again.
So with that in mind, it must be amazing to get an identification. It must be, I don't know, quite what emotion is that like?
Undescribable. It's unfortunately it only happened a few times, but Walker was very special. The other ones were a bit more difficult because two more were found in that German mass grave, and they did have that identity disc, German, the early ones. So we knew we would be able to identify because we very clearly could read the disc, but those early ones just had a number on it and not a name yet, so we still had to go through.
I suppose you had to catch yourself a little bit. It's like, yeah. Right, I've got to stay professional with this, but you know, it's a great feeling.
It is, and it's sometimes it's we have to admit, hard to not to be like be joyful and cheerful, which is contradictory to what you are doing at the moment. But it's just that, yeah, knowing that he's no longer an unknown missing soldier. That's one of the biggest reasons why you do or we do what we do.
So I mean, I'm going to ask some geeky questions probably and the kind of technical stuff in a bit, but you know, just a final kind of point: is it ever difficult to balance the kind of emotional with the professional when you're doing what you do?
Not when I'm at work in the field, because then I can have make that click and just have that focus. But I do have to admit, sometimes driving home or searching, and especially the closer that you get to an identification, that makes it hard. And once you know, like for Walker, for example, I often talk about him, but each time I have those that like goosebumps, and I sometimes welling up thing. Because yeah, when I talk about talking to his family and I remember how grateful they were and what it meant to them that we found him when we took them to, because some of them came over for the ceremony and his reburial, and we took them to the location where we found him, and there they just fell onto the ground and started crying, and yeah, those moments are, yeah. And then it would be strange, I think, if you're not getting emotional from that as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, I guess I get the same in a slightly more distant way from war diaries from time to time, you know, because you end up following some guy who's writing for his battalion, and then he ends up getting hit, or, you know, I'm doing the Hindenburg line stuff. You have a booby trap where the battalion CO, 2IC, the adjutant who writes the diary, one of the company commanders, the medical officer, and even the battalion padre, you know, they're all killed in one go. And it's like, oh, you know, and I'm supposed to be objective and proper historian, like, it must be tough.
You could argue, I suppose, that if you didn't have that emotion, you wouldn't be able to fully connect to the stories and be understand their impact. I suppose I think you need that emotional, you need to have that connection with the work that you're doing, whether it be archaeology or whether it be war diaries.
Exactly. It's you have to be like objective and be like professional to a certain level, but we're all humans as well, and learning their stories and getting so close to them, because there's almost no way to getting closer to them than actually recovering them from the soil, and that step makes them human again as well, and that makes the whole history of the war about humans, which is often just a story, a bigger story, but finding them and finding their objects and what they've been doing and what they've been handling is making it all more about them. And then it would be strange not to have that emotional connection, I think.
Are there any kind of jobs where, I don't know, you're called, I mean, you're quite often linked to like civil engineering, your work. If there's something going on in Flanders through an area that was once battlefield, chances are, you know, you're going to get a call at some point. Are there any kind of jobs that you've done where you've thought beforehand, oh yeah, we are definitely going to find some stuff here, or anything maybe that surprised you, any particular kind of periods or places where you thought, yes, we're definitely going to find something, or maybe you're expecting to find something and didn't?
It always happens that you go out with big expectations, but then it turns out that someone was there before you and nobody, or people forgot about it, and then all the expected history is just gone and destroyed by earlier construction of farmers, or like in some areas they dug up a lot of clay as well, and that's not always like in the 50s, 60s, it wasn't always written down in books, and locations were forgotten, and then you start looking at maps and aerial photography and you know, oh, this is a very, very interesting spot. And then you come up there and you start opening up the field, and you see that at some point they dug big holes to get the clay out of the ground. But with doing that, they destroyed everything that was out of interest for us. So, but in other cases, you go out and you find what you expect and even more. And then, yeah. That's the exciting part of the job, of course. You never know what you're going to get, and there's always a surprise coming. We do the desktop studies. We know before we go out what to expect, more or less, based on those aerial photography and trench maps. We know the major lines that were there, the trench lines. But it was a war that lasted 4 years, and a lot of that happened. And those, of course, they tried to mask a lot of things from the observation from the air as well. So there's always a lot more than you that you would have anticipated on based on those sources. So that's what it makes it so so exciting and so special, that the surprise and you just cannot go out with and trying to find what you have on that map. I always go out. I know that it's possible that we find it, but then you go back with the tabula rasa and you find what you find, and then you try to link it to the maps that you have and to the historical facts. And that's the same when you recover a body, that you, most of the time, speaking about Commonwealth forces, that lucky enough they have the brass shoulder titles, so they last longer than the cloth titles that the German soldiers had. So it's always like some anticipation and excitement when you get to the shoulders and when you find the cloth, and then within it some title, and then hopefully it's there, and then you can read it, and then you start. I can never wait until I get back home, so I will immediately start looking at, okay, that unit, what do I know here, the divisions that were here, what units were in there, which battalions, and then you can narrow down that list. And then often you, looking at equipment, you can narrow it down to, like, if they have equipment like gas masks, you know that it's definitely won't be from 1914 and not early 1915, especially if they have the smallpox respirator, you look all the way later. And then if there are a certain location on the front, that also narrows down possibilities, because and that it's that mix that brings that narrowed down that major massive list of possibilities to hopefully 10 or less or one. But of course in the field that never happens, and unfortunately in later stages that's also very difficult. And then you need a very extensive historical research to narrow down that list even more, if the sources survived the 100 years. The good example is Private John Lambert that was identified last year. He was a Newfoundlander. He was also found during the same excavation as Captain Walker. So it took about 4 years, 4 years until they were able to identify him. So they did a very thorough historical research, narrowed down the list, and then they did DNA sampling with some of the possible relatives, and then they had a match.
He must have been killed later. He must have been, August 17?
August 17, yeah. He was found at Steenbeek, just next to Rizzo Farm, Signal Farm, that area. They had quite some missing. And it was a very difficult case as well, because he was buried together with four other soldiers. I think two from the Hampshire Regiment and one from the Inniskilling Fusiliers. But their remains got mixed up because of later artillery fire. Yeah. So we knew we had four bodies, but we didn't. And one of them was a Newfoundlander, but we didn't know. So they took samples from four bone or skeleton remains that they knew it was from the four individuals, so probably femurs or something. And then they had to match those four with all the relatives. So it was quite a big undertaking to get to the point, but with a very satisfactory result, of course. Yeah. And he was also an interesting story, because he was only, I think, 17 years old when he was killed. He joined up when he was 16, just a year before, I think almost exactly a year earlier. Joined up 16, got trained and stuff, and I think he arrived at the front somewhere in June 1917, and then by 16th of August, he was already killed.
The mentality to join up like that, because the Newfoundlanders, I mean, a year previous, they'd just been smashed on the first day of the Somme, and, you know, to be a 16-year-old lad, you know, off in Newfoundland thinking, oh, right, I'm obviously can't leave it to anyone else. It's up to me to go out and fight the good fight as well. Amazing.
Simon, how often do you find one of your own countrymen?
I once found one Belgian soldier. Well, he was
numerically it's not very high, because the population wasn't very high. That's not like a criticism on them being lazy or anything, but there are less to find, aren't there?
Definitely, yeah. And according to some of the people I know that are familiar with the Belgian recoveries after the war, they were able to do it quite thoroughly. Of course, the scale was less, the area that they had to search was less big than the similar areas around Ypres.
Does it make a difference at all? I mean, I associate the Belgian sector with like breastworks built above the level of the ground rather than actual trenches. I don't know if, you know, the whole of the Belgian sector was like that. Is that a more difficult job to excavate, or do you find less in that sort of circumstance?
Trenches are very hard to find in that sector, because most of it is on above ground. So what we do find are those burrow ditches that were in front or on the back of the trenches. So we can follow the trench lines, but the actual trench that was in between those ditches is often gone. So that, yeah, it's a completely different kind of excavation in that area. But I think also there's, because it's very, the Belgian front in that area is going through a very agricultural area, whereas there's less development. So there's not that many, only around Dixmuiden, there've been a few excavations. And I think in the 2016-17, four Belgian soldiers were found in that area. Three of them were identified, but I wasn't part of the three that were identified. I found another one he was buried together with some Frenchmen. So all part of the 1914 battle. And I suppose because they did, there were not that many missing throughout the war as well. Because of less big battles going on in that area. So most of the casualties that we recovered are 1914, and I think in 2016 we found them, and it was before that, 1950 or something, that the last Belgian soldier was found.
I've got kind of one more question, and it's because I'm a child and I'm interested in things that go bang, and that's pretty much what got me into military history in the first place.
If we didn't ask the big bangy thing, Peter Hart would never forgive us, ever.
Yeah, how is danger a part of the work that you just accept, or are you kind of desensitized to it? I mean, the amount of munitions that you must uncover through your work. I mean, you're digging away as carefully as you can, and all of a sudden there's a 12-inch high explosive round, or you know, there's maybe a Livens round that might be full of any horrible gas or anything. What do you do in that situation?
In most of the cases, we are under the guidance of an EOD expert.
Can I just say that do you remember? Do you still have the Santa Claus guy, the one who? I'm pretty sure he knew it was safe already, but on that dig in 2013, he just walks up and kicked an artillery shell, and I said, "Aren't you worried it'll explode?" And he went, "No, I'm old, I've had loads of wives, I just don't care anymore."
He retired.
Okay, but he didn't get blown up, right?
No, he survived.
Boom, retirement, yeah.
He retired on the normal way. For them, they laugh about it, but they're actually quite serious. I suppose if he kicked it, he knew what he was doing, and it
I think
he was
just showing off.
Yeah, probably was it, or an empty shell, or one that wasn't fired, and considered less dangerous because all the mechanisms were not activated yet. But usually we always, not on the small recovery things that, like when we were called out for a chance find, then we don't have EOD, but then we do everything by shovel and hand. If we encounter something that we really do not trust, then of course we let the police, we call the police, and they would call Belgian EOD, Army EOD. It's, you kind of get used to it, but you don't want to allow yourself to get so used to it that it's getting common. You still have to be, each second you have to be aware that it can be there and that it's still dangerous. But luckily, apart from maybe a few phosphors that went off, started to like smoke coming out, and then you can cover it and it's done, and then you let the EOD come in. No explosions happened so far.
I'm gonna walk away from this one now.
So Simon, just want to briefly talk about some of the work that you're doing at the moment with your brand new venture with Skylarks, which is such an amazing venture to watch grow. Could you just tell us a bit more about what you're doing with that venture, you know, what the whole plan is for what you're doing?
It's originated from like a subsidy that is granted by the Flemish government. So the Flemish Heritage Agency gives an annual amount of money to a certain set of projects. They divide it to different projects each year. And we submitted the project last year, Missing at the Front. What we want to do is, because it wasn't there yet, is make a complete overview of all the recoveries that has been done archaeologically in the past 30 years. So the idea of that subsidy is to give the money to projects that look at archaeology that's done in the past 30 years, because that's the time of the Malta Agreement, which is a short explanation when that's for the whole of Europe. If archaeology is to be destroyed by infrastructure, it's the people that are doing the infrastructural works that need to pay and be responsible for the archaeology and just hire an archaeological firm. But very often that information of all those many, many excavations is very splintered, and we are now trying to bring that together. So that's what we want to do with the Missing at the Front project, about the recovery of skeletal remains of the First World War. So we will look at how many are found, and then we will do, with the database that we are building, do an analysis on how many nationalities, where are they found, what kind of graves are there, just field graves, or more of them just buried in shell holes or in trenches. Is there an evolution going through the war? Like if there's, if you archaeologically can find out if like they took less or more care for the death in the beginning or the end of the war, and that kind of stuff. And then with some historical sources, we will also have a look at the landscape of the missing, which means that we will try to pinpoint all the locations over many as possible of where soldiers were killed, and try to find out if that tells us something historically as well. Looking at battles, if some areas are heavily fought over, what's the cost for that area, which is already giving us very interesting insights and results. We, for example, look at if you have a name that you know is buried, where was his body recovered from? If he was killed according to his sources at the front, but you find out that he was recovered on the route back to the front or on the other side of the front because he was recovered by the enemy and then eventually died there. That's all that kind of stuff that we're trying to put in numbers and historical evidence. And that eventually will end up in a report and in an exhibition in the Ian Flanders Fields Museum. So that will open in on the end of January next year. So that's something we look forward to a lot. And for that, we are still building the story. So we will not only do all the more hard facts and numbers, but we also want to find like the real stories. Of course, we have the stories that we've been talking about today, but stories about people, what it means to people that still have relatives missing, or people that are still looking for relatives. So
you want to hear from people, don't you?
Yeah, definitely. The more stories we get in, the more we can build a nice exhibition around that. So just be a call out to people that want to share a story.
Hit Skylarks up on Twitter or the Great War Group, because we're working with them. Speaking of which, Simon, this has been amazing. People are just going to be, once again, mesmerised by you. You're going to have to get used to being a war bore celebrity, I'm afraid. Where can people hear more from you?
They can follow me on my Twitter handle, which is just at Simon Verdigan. I try to now and then share some of the work we are doing. And of course, also at Skylarks, our Twitter account, but also on our website, which is brand new. And we are planning to share stories on there as well when the project is continuing and growing. So I think those are the two major things. And from there on, you can just catch up with what we are doing.
Excellent. And might you be talking at an event later this year?
I will share some of the results on the conference in Maidenhead, the Great War Group conference in October. So I'm really looking forward to that, because that will be the first location where we will share what we are been doing the past couple of months with the Missing at the Front project.
We're very excited to hear about it. Simon, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure, and then thank you.
You can help us at History Hack by joining us via Patreon. It takes quite a lot of effort and a lot of work of quite a big team now to keep us going. And so if you could donate as little as £3 a month, it would be massively appreciated by all of us. There's different levels because Princess Marcus has set it all up with varying rewards and things. So do have a look, do join us. There's an exclusive Facebook group as well, and you could be part of all of it.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/hackhistory, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.